This conference will now be recorded.
Hello, this is the Reading Odyssey's Herodotus 2014-2015 call. It is Wednesday, 9/17/2014, and tonight we will be discussing Book 1 of Herodotus. I am Rebecca Kennedy, and I'm the moderator for the call. Since this is our first call, we will also begin with brief introductions. I've asked Phil Terry, the founder of Reading Odyssey, to kick us off with a few words. Do you want to go ahead and start, Phil?
Sure. Thank you, Rebecca. And thank you so much for moderating. I just wanted to say a few words of welcome to everyone. It's, we started Reading Odyssey in 2005 when my best friend from college and I decided that we wanted to read so much of the great books of the Western tradition over the rest of our lives together. And so we started with Homer, and pretty soon a bunch of friends and people in the business world and the music world piled on. And when we got to Herodotus, I reached out to Professor John Marincola at Florida State, who edited the Penguin edition. The Landmark was not yet out. And I asked him if he'd come spend an hour with us by phone, and he did, and we had a great time. And from there, we ended up meeting Bob Strassler, who's the founder and editor of the Landmark series of books, including Herodotus and Thucydides and Xenophon and others, and then Professor Paul Cartledge, who is one of the most eminent scholars in the classics world today at Cambridge University. We ended up forming a nonprofit with these scholars and other readers on our board and have produced programs, a lecture series. We had hundreds of thousands of participants in our Marathon 2500 series a couple of years ago with reading groups and lectures all over the world. But the heart of the Reading Odyssey remains this experience where 8 or 10 or 12 people get together with the moderator and spend several months reading a text like Herodotus. I've now read Herodotus fully, full way through twice. Rebecca has obviously done more than that as a professor. And we're so lucky to have someone of her caliber with us today and through this whole reading group. But I'll never forget the first time I read it. And it is a challenging text. And for some of you, I hope some of you, this is completely new. Some of you, I have the sense you've read other texts. Perhaps you've even read Herodotus or at least parts of it before. Maybe you have some familiarity with the ancient Greek. But we're with the Reading Odyssey, we really want to reach people who've never touched the stuff before, and certainly help adults discover how wonderful these texts can be. And this was a challenging text, but immensely rewarding in my opinion. And I want to encourage you to stick with it. You know, there's a lot here. Of course, we're going to be doing this slowly, about a book a month over the next 8 months, and really support each other. The most important thing you can do in this reading group is actually do the reading itself. The contributions and the discussions and the connections you make with the readers will be also a tremendous pleasure if past is prologue for this group. But reading the text is, and you're going to have a lot of questions. And my recommendation in terms of reading a text like Herodotus is that if you don't understand something, if you come across something that you don't understand, feel free to note it, but most importantly, keep going. Just keep going. It will begin to emerge. And then when you come to a call like this and you can bring up questions, and you'll discover other points of view and certainly that other readers struggle with certain similar or different things. But just keep going, because the whole thing will begin to emerge. And it really is. I think the eighth wonder of the world, this text. So I thank you for putting real time into tackling this text. We will be reading in the spring of next year after this Thucydides, and I really encourage you to one step at a time read this. But once you're done with this, I think you'll really want to keep going. And the two books together are an incredible experience. Herodotus and Thucydides, and they have a kind of conversation with each other, as you'll see later. But we also do other reading groups, and we're planning the lecture series for the 2,500 year anniversary of the Battle of Thermopylae, and there's other things that you can get involved in. But most importantly, read the text and keep going if you run into trouble. Don't let it keep you down. And of course, you can reach out to Rebecca at any point. But that's so. I just wanted to say a few words of welcome to all of you. And I wanted to again thank Rebecca, who has so graciously agreed to bring her passion, her expertise to running this group.
Thank you. So
thanks.
Thank you. I want to add just a couple of notes to Phil's recommendation because I think it's a really good one. But I think also importantly is as you're reading through Herodotus, don't worry if you think something is strange or if you're not sure how it's going to work. Because Herodotus doesn't think like us. And, you know, he's sort of at the cusp of written communication. He's still sort of writing in a semi-oral tradition. So, but I encourage you guys that as you're actually reading, to just write little notes to yourself to make sure that you don't forget what you had questions about or what you found was odd. I always use those little sticky things that in the professional world they use to mark, you know, where you're supposed to sign a contract. I have my books just sort of spotted with them on.
And I do too.
They're colorful. But they do a good job. Thank you, Phil. I know that most of you guys sent around emails with introductions. But what I'd like us to have us do is have everyone give your name and say where you're calling from. And then say a sentence or two about why you decided to read Herodotus. I don't think anyone needs an excuse to read Herodotus, but you know, you may have made one up in your mind so that you could have a reason to do this. So that way we can do that. And then what I will do is as we go through the call and discuss the reading, I will try and call on people to make sure that we're getting everyone included who wants to be included in the conversation. And if I ask you something, you don't have to answer. There will not be a test at the end of the day, and I will not be giving you a grade. So if you don't want to answer, you could say, you know, I'm not really sure. How about let's ask someone else? And we'll go ahead and move on to there. We just want to try and prevent too much.
I have a question or a request, if possible.
Yeah. Yes.
At some point, are we going to discuss the role of women in this? Because it's kind of...
We will.
Yes.
I think that one of the things I'd like to do is get into a couple of books before we do that. Hello?
Okay. Thank you.
Just because it would be a really good idea, as far as I'm concerned, if we have a couple of examples when we get into Egypt in book two, it might be a really great time to start bringing it up because Herodotus gets really obsessed with gender roles when he's talking about a lot of the foreign cultures. So it would be a really good topic to bring up and work with. It's one of the favorite things in Herodotus to think about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll definitely be doing that. Hello? Is there someone new on the call?
No, I think there's just some background noise.
Oh, okay. All right, then why don't we start with Leah, why don't you start, introduce yourself. I just told them who you are. Say where you're calling from and then tell us why you decided to do Herodotus.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, my name is Leah. I'm calling from Maine, Portland, Maine. I'm a senior in high school, and I want to read Herodotus because he's a really cool guy. And I was in Boston a couple of months ago, and I saw a bust, this beautiful marble bust of Herodotus. And I said to myself, wow, you know, I like to think of myself as a budding classicist, but I should probably read, you know, the first historian. So that's really why it just sort of hit me that, oh, you know what? Herodotus, I've never really read him before, so that's why.
Good. Lisa, do you want to go ahead?
Oh, sure. I basically have been running a book club for over 8 years at the museum where I work, and I always have trouble with nonfiction, and I've always been a huge fan of Greek history and classical anything. So I just am kind of was curious mostly.
And where are you calling from?
Oh, I'm sorry. I live in Thousand Oaks, California, and I am currently in my last 45 minutes at work, so I'm doing two things at once.
No problem, right? And how about Kevin? Tell us where you're calling from and why you want to
be Veronica. Okay, I'm calling from Rimini, New York, about 100 miles north of New York City and about 80 miles south of Albany toward the Connecticut border. I'm a retired college professor. I've read Herodotus off and on, but just rather, as I see now, an improper way. That is just browsing. And when you're browsing, things come out in a one-dimensional way. So now I realize that reading him all through, that it's far more interesting. That different things are, larger things are going on than just reporting facts.
That's right. Thank you. Katerina.
Hi, everyone. I'm from New York City, and I'm, I guess Phil will be happy to know I'm completely new to this book, and I'm also reading it out of curiosity. I'm a freelance writer, and I'm intrigued by any text that has an element of immortality to it, so that's what's drawing me to this.
Yeah. And how about Dwight? Thanks, Katerina. Hello?
Hello?
Dwight?
Are you there, Dwight?
Okay, sorry, I had to unmute. Fred Whitaker just joined. I'm a former...
Oh. Hey, just hang on a second, Dwight. Fred Whitaker just joined. Rebecca, I don't know if you heard that.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Nope. Welcome, okay. Fred.
Hey, Fred. We're going to have Dwight introduce himself, and then we're just going around right now and doing introductions for everyone. Okay?
Great.
All right. Dwight, go ahead.
Okay. Hi. I'm calling from a suburb of San Jose, California. This is my third, and I'm actually looking forward into the third, fourth, and fifth reading because there's a couple of new translations, and I'm anxious to compare all of them. My background is finance and accounting, but I've always loved reading, and so I started a literature blog about 9 years ago now, and I one of my favorite series of posts was on the histories, and it's one of my favorite books of all time, period. And I'm looking forward to revisiting it several times through.
You can never, every time you read this, you'll find something new and interesting. Okay, Andrew.
Yes, I'm calling from Houston, Texas. I've been wanting to read Herodotus for years, but it's kind of intimidating looking at an 800-page book. And one thing that's an impediment with books like this is there's so many different editions out there, like Homer, Virgil, lots of different editions, and which one do you choose? So I finally settled on the two-volume Heritage Press edition from 1958 a couple of months ago, which is charmingly illustrated but has no maps. You don't have to read too far into book one to realize you're going to be hopelessly lost without maps. So that is when I decided to buy the Landmark edition, which I was aware of, but for some reason I didn't buy. I guess I like older books. And it was only a day or two after that I discovered the Reading Odyssey. So I took that as a sign from the gods. And here I am.
They do send us these messages. Did you see birds flying by on the right when you made the decision?
I forgot to look up, but yeah, they were probably flying overhead.
As long as they were not crows, you're okay.
Yeah, so if you find the 1958 Heritage Press edition in a used bookstore, I recommend buying it just for the quaint and charming illustrations, but it's pretty useless as a viable edition with maps. So this Strassler version is a godsend.
Yeah, it's actually, when I was in graduate school, the one thing I was told when I was, you know, getting ready to teach history courses was you could not teach history without a map.
Yeah.
No such thing. So I have a whole slew of maps.
And it's also, you'll be glad to know I have the 1958 Heritage edition.
Good.
Plastic on my bookshelf with several other editions. I love it, but the maps are absolutely, it's incredible. And
yes.
we'll talk to you later about how Bob Strassler created these maps, because that in itself is a great story.
May I just say, additionally, I probably would have continued to put off reading it even after getting the landmark edition, just because it's such an intimidating text. So it's really great to have the Reading Odyssey there to kind of give you the direction and guidance that people need to read a seminal book like this.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. Maggie, how about you?
Okay, hi everyone. I'm calling from Los Angeles, and I think really the primary reason why I wanted to do this is because I think I left a huge part of myself back in college at Occidental, and I wanted to recreate some of that experience. So it's the text feels brand new in many ways. I think it was the Penguin edition in class.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, I initially balked at the cost of it, I have to be honest, when I went on to Amazon.com. But seeing all the maps and how enriching the introduction was, I was obviously mistaken. So it's been a pleasure kind of taking myself back to my college days.
Thanks, Maggie. Bill.
Hi, I'm calling from outside of Nashville, Tennessee, and I've heard Herodotus mentioned several times in some other readings and a couple of talks, and I thought about time I sit down and get through a copy of his original work. So it's going to be great. I was a little intimidated when the book arrived, but so far so good. Looking forward to the discussion.
Excellent. Thanks, Bill. Alexander.
Hi, everyone. I'm calling from Greece, actually. And
wow.
The reason I decided to read it is I'm a reader of Dwight's blog. It's one of those things that I was going to read sooner or later. And when I saw the post, I decided now was probably a good time.
Always a good time
That's
to read Herodotus.
Wow.
Yeah, I was in Athens last year, and of course, I read ancient Greek. I don't read modern Greek, and I was walking down Herodotus Street, but of course, I didn't realize it because it was spelled differently.
Oh, really? Did it not like have the? Do they have accents in modern Greek or?
Oh yeah,
breathing?
Yeah. The spellings are slightly different. So I realized it about 20 minutes walking down the road. Oh, I'm on Herodotus Street.
That's awesome.
Okay, and Fred.
And of course they didn't have breathing marks in ancient Greek. That's a modern addition to ancient Greek.
Kind of an
irony.
Greek,
yeah.
Fred, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, go ahead and introduce.
Okay, I am Fred Whitaker. I'm a lawyer by day and community politician by evening. I'm driving right now through the because I had a client meeting that went too long. And Phil Terry got me into this. I read for a living, and so it's just kind of fun to do some reading that is not professional. And I like studying the classics. I love history, and I was a history major in college.
Excellent. Okay, well, thanks for introducing yourself. I guess I could introduce myself. My name is Rebecca Kennedy, and I'm in wonderful, beautiful Grahamville, Ohio. I was just out in Los Angeles this weekend, and I'm already missing Southern California, since that's where I grew up. But I'm here. I teach at Denison University here, and actually, my reason for getting into Herodotus is because I love history, and when I went to college, I took Greek, and I fell in love with it. And they were teaching Herodotus. Actually, when I was in my first year of Greek, I was apparently so exceptional, they put me into the advanced Greek at the same time. I think it was because the class was under-enrolled, not because I was brilliant. but it was Herodotus, and it was just so fascinating and so delightful. And I try and read him. I teach him in Greek regularly. I teach him in English even more regularly. And I try to read him whenever I can, because every time I read him, something new comes out of it that I didn't think of before, or that I didn't notice before. It's one of those books. It's like, it's a deep well that you can just keep going back to over and over again. So I'm really happy to be participating in this. I was a little daunted because you're all strangers. And shockingly, as a college professor, I am afraid of strangers. But I think we'll do okay as long as we don't all talk over top of each other, right?
Yes.
Right. Like, everyone's now afraid to talk. Right? No, I just want to make sure that the technology doesn't screw us up. So I'm always afraid of technology. That's a standard classics professor problem. All right. Now, I thought we would go ahead and let's go ahead and start with our questions. One of the things that I want to do is I want us to use the questions as a way to think about as we're approaching the reading, but these are not things that you're restricted to. Anything that you want to bring into the conversation and steer towards, I think that's really fine. These are sort of a starting point for us to think about, not the end-all, be-all of the conversation. So, and one of the things that you can also do is in the month in between the calls, if you want to, feel free to sort of, if something is really jumping out at you that you want to get into the conversation, you know, we have the Facebook group, and we also, you could just shoot an email to me, and I can make sure I maybe if send it out, like, for example, the question about whether or not we are going to discuss the role of women in Herodotus. We most definitely want to talk about the role of women in Herodotus, and we can do it in a variety of different ways and different books, because they'll come up again and again. There are a lot of interesting and powerful women in this book. So, like I said, these are not meant to be restricted. They're meant to be sort of as a jumping off point. And actually, what I wanted to do is actually jump off with a question that was not on the list, but I thought maybe I would start with. And what we're going to do is I'm going to go backwards from the people who introduced themselves first. I'm going to start with Fred, and we'll sort of work our way back and maybe jump around a little bit. But I thought I would start us off by asking us, what did we think of the beginning of Herodotus, this opening bit of Herodotus? And one of the things I do want to say is when we talk about an ancient text like Herodotus, the best thing to do if you want to refer specifically to the text is not to point to the landmark page number, but on that sidebar in the text, you'll see what are paragraph numbers. And that means that anybody who's reading with us, even if they don't have their landmark with them, those are the uniform numbers. So everyone will know what that is. It'll show up in every text. So if you want to refer directly to the text, try and refer to that page, that paragraph number, so that everyone can easily find it. Okay? So what do we think about the opening of Herodotus here? What is he doing? Where are we starting? And why don't we start? Who wants to start, actually? Fred's driving. I don't want to put him on the spot.
I'd like to say something about it. I found it both it's comic and tragic at the same time, his discussion of myths, and the myth of rape in particular. It's comic because the stories kind of apply to everybody, and it becomes part of this xenophobic national identity but everybody, including the Greeks themselves, when they were barbarian attacked. But it's also very tragic because if a famous queen is being abducted, that also means 50, 100 or more other women are being abducted. And I think, taken into slavery. And if you think, 100 women are abducted and they all have four or five children in slavery, he's talking about how these different major tribes have expanded their populations rather quickly and become more powerful, nascent states. So, I actually came across a historian who said that Herodotus wasn't a historian because he believed in myths. He's not believing in myths. He's just reporting the anthropology of these legends rather than believing in them. And if they have veracity, it is, as I said, it's this tragic history of how certain tribes expanded their territory.
Yeah, it's actually interesting, right? We're going to start off with this, the question of is he a historian? Is he an anthropologist? Is he a mythographer? These are modern distinctions in some ways, not really ancient ones.
I think I pretty much invented anthropology.
He is the father of lots of things.
I think he pretty much invented anthropology.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a guy named Hecateus.
Sorry, what?
But there was a guy named Hecateus who preceded him, but was more of a geographer, anthropologist. But who else would like to say something about this opening of Herodotus and what seems to be going on here and what he's doing?
Can I say something real quick?
Yes.
Well, I think that...
Just say your name, just so we can get to know.
My name is Maggie.
Oh, good.
That's Maggie.
Thank you. Thanks. Okay. The first thing I was struck by was how I live now, that everything is memorialized on YouTube and, Google and... everything from what I eat to, a president's statement on something, and that doesn't seem like it was always the case back then. Because he says, I'm writing this down so that people don't forget. It struck me how far we've come, how different it is. We sort of take these things for granted that everything will be recorded, memorialized, and I think for technological reasons and. Maybe just cultural reasons, difference in written and oral traditions, wasn't always that way.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at this opening bit, he's very concerned about making sure that people don't forget these deeds. And this is a tradition, I think he's hearkening back to Homer here a bit. You make an epic poem and he's making an epic history, as it were. How about, does anyone else want to add anything to this?
This is Andrew. I've got several things I wanted to go over on this opening. First of all, Herodotus only uses the word myth twice in the entire book. The Greek word mythos.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I just sneezed.
Oh, okay. So Herodotus only uses the word myth twice in the entire book, but obviously he's dealing with a lot of what we would refer to as mythical material. Second of all, the abduction of the women, there's a very interesting observation I found at paragraph 4, where he says, according to the Persians, it is the way of sensible people to have no concern for abducted women. And then, moreover, they say that because the women would not have been abducted had they not been compliant. And I read that and realized this sounds torn from today's headlines where people say, oh, well, some people say outrageously that, oh, well, women want to be raped, that women who are raped want to be raped. That there's a lot of blaming the victim whenever a male feels like his power is threatened or something.
I thought the same thing.
This struck me as just being such an eternal, universal problem with the male mentality. Now, of course, I have no idea if the Persians actually claimed this, but it's just remarkable to read that in a 2,400-year-old book.
Well, you know, if you've, there are a lot of texts where you will read that. It's not, it seems to have been codified in law in many regions. That so if the woman is raped in her home, there's two different ways that it goes. If a woman is raped in her own home, she's guiltless. And the guy who, like, so in Athens, she would not be charged with a crime, but the guy who did it would be considered a criminal because it's a property crime.
Yes, he broke it. Yes, property. Right.
But then in some cultures in the Near East and in ancient antiquity, this is all in antiquity, if the woman was out away from the home a certain distance, then she wouldn't have been out there, the claim is, if she wasn't looking for someone or trying to meet someone.
Yes,
they get wrapped
yes.
up in adultery laws as well. So it is one of these things that's very, we think of ourselves as different from the Greeks in many ways, but there are a lot of things that will jump out that will strike us as similar. And sometimes those similarities aren't things that we necessarily are proud that we still haven't gotten over or progressed from in some ways.
Well, and that's one of the, sorry for interrupting, that's one reason why people should read ancient texts is to realize in so many ways human psychology and attitude hasn't changed very much at all in 2,400 years, for better or for worse.
Yeah, and the thing that's really interesting, I think I would like to point out, and then I thought we'd jump into some of the other questions, is that the way that Herodotus sets all of this up is he does it all as a, this is a technique that we're going to see with Herodotus throughout the history. And we want to think about this as he's doing it, is that oftentimes he will give us, and they say this, and they say that, and these people say this. And very rarely will he actually assert his own interpretation. He doesn't say, but I think X. He'll do this at only a few locations, and so we want to sort of think about that. When he is telling these stories, is he actually vouching for the truth value of these stories that he's telling? And if he isn't, why is he telling it to us? What's his purpose?
Well,
so,
I think many times he's reporting points of view that from different places on the globe.
He's going to be recording points of view, but he excludes some things on purpose, and he'll actually call to question some other things. So I just thought I'd point it out as a way for us to sort of keep in mind that this is a technique that he uses, but sometimes he'll break that technique, and we want to sort of perk up our ears a little bit when he does take a stand for or against a specific viewpoint. We may want to think about why he's marking that. The other thing I thought would move us in, because this first story with Croesus, which is one of the greatest all-time stories from Herodotus, he really starts us off with a couple of, it seemed like non sequiturs, but then we get into these sort of charming little stories that are often excerpted out from the greater work. And we begin with the story of Croesus, who immediately moves us into the story of Candaules and Gyges. So I guess we could go ahead. Let's go ahead and start with the actual real first question that was on today about the issue of prophecy and how prophecy seems to be working throughout. And why don't we see Katerina, did you want to say something in here, or do you want us to give someone
else? Well, I actually wanted to backtrack to what you said about the opening.
Sure.
I also noticed how he set himself up as a neutral observer and how, not having read the whole assignment, how that's the technique that is used by some people, especially in metaphysical texts, to encourage the reader to develop their own opinion without being swayed one way or the other, and sort of to raise your consciousness and grow into how you might draw your own conclusion from what you're reading, without sort of being pushed into a definitive conclusion for anything. So I think, I think that really is one reason it could be like an endless well when you read it and your consciousness changes in your own life and you're reading the book again, maybe for the second, third, or tenth time, you'll find a different meaning. It's similarly to the way the Bible affects people, I think, where a child can read it, an adult can read it, and the meaning will always have something different to show them.
Yeah, and something to think about, too, is the period when Herodotus is writing this down is when rhetoric is developing. Mm-hmm. And the hallmark of ancient rhetoric is the ability to argue both sides of the question. So just throw that out there as well. Okay, so do we want to talk about the issue of prophecy? Do you want to say something, Katerina, or do you want, you feel like...
No, you can go on with that. Yeah.
Okay, how about, see here, who hasn't gone? Dwight, did you want to talk about this a little bit? Or some other questions from things? You can bring up whatever you want here.
Sure, no. It's interesting to see the role that gods play in Herodotus' histories. They never directly appear like you're used to seeing in, say, the Iliad or the Odyssey, where they directly intervene or they fight amongst each other to stay out of intervening. But they still appear, and it's usually in, I think, like oracles and dreams, things like that. And so that you get this feeling that you still can't escape your fate, which is a strong theme throughout the Iliad and the Odyssey. It's going to happen regardless. It's how you face it. It's how you deal with it. And so that's sort of that the paranormal, whatever, the godlike, and you know, the man sphere, the human sphere, sort of how they interact still sticks with me, how he paints that.
Okay, Kevin, in the Odyssey, I think Homer is self-consciously creating a new religion, the religion of Athena, whereas Herodotus, it seems to me, is basically an agnostic, and he's just reporting different things and finding ironies.
Let's see here. Alexander, did you want to add something?
Yeah, one thing that struck me is that you'll notice the frequency with which people go see the Oracle of Delphi in Book 1. Now, some of you may know more about this than I, but it's my understanding that going to see the Oracle of Delphi was even harder than, much harder than seeing the President of the United States. It was not like it's portrayed in Book 1, where it seems like anybody can go at any time.
Well, who's actually going to see the Oracle?
Well, actually, yeah. This is Fred. It seemed very expensive to go to the Oracle of Delphi.
Exactly.
And these guys who are going have a lot of money.
Yeah, you'll notice that Croesus, after he receives an oracle, sends a lot of gold and jewels and things to the oracle in gratitude.
There's a proverb from antiquity that you are as rich as Croesus.
Yeah, right.
He's excessively wealthy. He's sort of one of these characters that it's a proverbial for his wealth. Bill, did you want to add anything in here?
The interesting part is that he seems to bridge both the old world and the new here with some of the prophecies, and maintains the fact that the gods are there and the gods are true prophecy, either directly or spoken through the oracles. But it seems to be that it doesn't matter what the gods say, mankind is doomed to misinterpret what the gods tell them each time.
Yeah.
They either misread it or understand it. It's almost like he's chuckling to the side and saying, your luck will eventually run out.
I'm sorry.
Who is that?
As Fred, I took it a little differently. I thought it was fascinating that the prophecy, you know, at least two different times, you know, somebody misinterpreted the prophecy. You know, one where his son goes and dies by the spear in the boar hunt, and the other one where the they thought the attack would end a great empire. It was just his own. And in both cases, after some, initial anger, they realized actually it was their own fault for interpreting. So it's almost like, okay, I'm going to take responsibility for it. So I thought that was, these leaders eventually take kind of responsibility for them. Well, it was my fault.
Thanks, Fred.
I think you find some humor in the ambiguity of the oracles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is a really important thing to keep on our radar. Is humor. I don't think we want to conceptualize Herodotus as the first hipster who finds irony in everything. I think sometimes he actually is being funny or is finding humor. I also spend a lot of time in Nashville, so I know a hipster when I see one. Not that Bill is one, but Nashville is the hipster capital of the U.S. So, Leah, did you want to add anything in here?
I guess you know how you were talking about how Herodotus finds the humor in everything. I mean, he seems to me to be like sort of a funny guy. I mean, he is recounting all these stories that he heard, or well, we have to assume that he's heard, but he puts a funny spin on it, like Croesus's dream about his son Actus, and like, he's apparently going to be killed by this iron spear or whatever. And so finally he lets his son go out hunting, but then, I forget where it is. But Herodotus says something like, he explains how the spear was not a spear of war. It was a spear of hunting, and how, Chris's dream was indeed prophetic, but not in the way he assumed it would be. So that was a little bit of humor I found.
Once again, the prophecy turned out to be not what they expected.
Exactly.
It's always the case.
Exactly. It's like, oh, no, you should have been looking out for that spear, dude.
Human beings don't have the wisdom to figure out these prophecies.
Well, sometimes you hear what you want to hear, you know.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I think I personally think that's part of the point. You hear what you want to hear when you want to hear it sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah. I find, this you know, is, I mean, to be honest, sometimes it's the same thing when I'm sitting in the pew on a Sunday morning listening to sermon. I mean, you know, sometimes you hear what you want to hear.
This is Dwight. I did want to point out. Yeah, thanks. There is the one interesting thing, and to Phil's point, it's like he's trying to bridging between two worlds, and he's kind of uncomfortable in either world completely. And so there's the one explanation. You know, Croesus goes to the Oracle of Apollo and says, "Hey, what happened?" And Apollo comes back and says, "I allowed you as much as the fates would concede, you know, your fated destiny is impossible to avoid even for a god." And I'm sorry, I don't have the paragraph number.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's an important thing, that's still the overriding factor. Fate will happen. You may not know and you may not interpret correctly what we give you, and it's going to happen regardless.
Yeah. This is Kevin again. I think on an overarching architecture, there's a contrast going on between the oracles and the common sense wisdom and advice that you find first in Solon and then in Croesus after he messes up. And it's that common sense advice that's far more important, I think, it was privileged from Herodotus' point of view, because it's rational rather than, you know, invoking superstition.
Thanks, Kevin. This actually is an interesting thought, and I'm wondering if we might want to sort of think about how maybe this idea of sort of how the prophecies are working, but also how they're reacting to them. Maybe we want to think about this in terms of how Herodotus relates the stories about the Persians, right? Because he's going to start with this story of the women, and then he's going to move to the story of the Lydians, moving to Candales and to Gyges. But then he's going to move into the history of the founding of the Persian kingdom under the Medes and the origins of Cyrus. And how do we see these ideas sort of still moving through of the way he continues to characterize the kings? You know, sort of if you look at questions 4, 5, and 6 all together in some ways, and the totality of book one in some ways, how you see these prophecies and these dreams and these human interactions with the gods sort of all coming, working its way through. Anybody have any thoughts on sort of how these the issues of prophecy and the gods sort of continues through in these more historical passages?
This is Andrew again. You're probably familiar with the term vaticinia ex eventu, prophecies after the fact. And I think that's something we have in play whenever prophecy, the subject of prophecy is brought up in any ancient context, that the prophecy, there never actually was a prophecy, that Cyrus came to power, Cyrus overthrew many nations, Cyrus eventually died, and then somebody started asking, how did this happen? How did Cyrus get so powerful? And they started coming up with these supposed prophecies that foretold the life of Cyrus.
And a lot of that is in the Old Testament too, right?
That same narrative is going on in the Old Testament as well. That your prophecy is not something. Although there was the Oracle of Delphi and there were historical prophetic figures, they're inventing these prophecies as a way to explain historical events, good or bad. Is my observation. I don't know if anyone else would agree with that.
Yeah, anybody else want to come in here? Maybe Maggie or Lisa?
Oh, I don't want to dominate. I've been contributing so much.
Anyone else? Leah?
Nope. I don't really know. I don't really know enough. I didn't really explore this enough, but I'd love to hear other people talk about it.
Well, what do you guys think, just sort of generally speaking, about how he sort of introduces the Persian kings and their history into the narrative, the sort of way he just introduces them, and how are we supposed to think about them, do you think, from how he's representing them here? Right? He brings in the first of our Median kings. Is he an example?
All the Persian kings are examples of different kinds of arrogance and different kinds of boasting and different kinds of ambitions. And then you see their fall as a result of that. So there is a kind of moralistic perspective being portrayed about human arrogance.
Well, I think
a great wealth leader.
Who is this here?
Yeah, it's Fred. I think that's also because it's a way for him to help show why the Persians or Asians are all more barbaric than the Greeks, right? So he can describe their histories and how they've fought to take over one another, the various stories of feeding one's son to his enemy as punishment. Those things, I think, all go to show not only the arrogance of those kings, but the brutality of those kings. And it paints a picture of the Persian society from the Greek perspective.
Yes.
Well, I wonder.
Right,
that's a pseudo-civilization. Yeah, I'm going to throw in a word of caution here because that is a very common interpretation. But I want us to keep that what Fred has just said in our heads when we get to the descriptions of the foundings of various Greek cities and also the Greek interactions with each other. Because I think you're going to see a lot of the same tropes and the same stories going around. And so then we'll want to think, like, yes, we get the Persians here, but we're going to get it with Scythians, Egyptians, and we're going to get it with Greeks as well. So I think he's a little bit more subtle than Greeks versus barbarians, but he's definitely characterizing them as these kings and kingship as something that is not necessarily a good thing. That's my view, but I want us to keep it on the radar, that keep these ideas in mind for as we move through the rest of the text to see who else is getting these character traits as we move through the history.
Yeah. I just want to agree with that, Rebecca. And it's a great comment, Fred. And I'll be interested to hear what you think, as Rebecca says, when we get to the portraits he paints of the other cities and civilizations.
Sure.
And I'll just tell you one thing. It gets a little cheating, but there were a number of Greeks who thought Herodotus, had gone over to the other side, that he was too much of a lover of the barbarians.
Yep. He's a barber of your loss.
Yes.
I'm sorry, this is Andrew interrupting again, but
sorry,
on that same note, Xenophon wrote an entire book about Cyrus.
Yep, and he was a fan of Cyrus.
So it's odd from our perspective that some of the Greeks seem to have made Cyrus into this great figure, and of course in the Bible he's referred to as a Messiah.
Well, because he returns them from the Babylonian exile.
Right, he defeated the Babylonians. So it's interesting that they have this love-hate relationship with Cyrus.
Yeah, I want us to keep on our radar, and maybe this is too much of the historian in me coming out, but I think something to consider is that when we talk about the Greeks, we often treat them as if they are a monolithic, singular entity, but in antiquity, they were not.
Sure.
Herodotus is writing at this moment when they're trying to self-define themselves as Hellenes, but it's not always working. And Herodotus is very conscientious about that, and I think he's trying to move them along a bit in considering themselves as more of a united people. But not even within a single polis, so Athens or Sparta, who are going to be our big players in the history, one group of Athenians actually might identify culturally and with their lifestyle more with these Persians than they would with some of their fellow Athenians, because they come from the super wealthy elite. So we want to think about the way that class resonates in Herodotus, because he's actually one of our great historians for telling us stories about the non-elite. He actually includes stories about the people who are sort of more of the average person. And I think that's something to always be conscientious about, that there's no such thing as a single Greek audience that would all understand Herodotus the same, or that Herodotus is representing.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. You're right.
I mean, just as we ourselves are all a different group of people who bring our own life experiences to the reading of this text, Herodotus's readers would have and listeners would have had the same experience.
Yeah.
And I just want to say one more thing about what Rebecca's saying. The maps in the Landmark edition will really help you understand the sense that the Greek world is very dispersed, and it's not monolithic politically, culturally. There's a shared language, and there is a sort of a broader shared culture. But in the ancient world, Greek cities went from modern-day Turkey to modern-day France. It spanned that kind of distance. And they had all kinds of fights and disagreements with each other. And as Rebecca points out, I have to say, it took me a long time to really understand it, reading a number of these texts. So, it'll seep in, but definitely use the maps. And Rebecca, I did want to ask one more thing. I forgot to suggest we do this, and it may be fine that we didn't do it.
But, oh yeah.
Is everyone comfortable with sort of the way, you know, the interface of the landmark book, the what, you know, the ways that he's using the maps? For example, the maps that show up only show the cities and places mentioned in the text in the previous two or three pages.
Right.
Right. And each time a place is referenced in the text, there's a footnote telling you where it is on the next map. And if you haven't done this already, I encourage you to let yourself sort of pause and follow that a little bit, because it will really enrich the experience for you. The other things to note are at the top of each page, right? First of all, it reminds us of the book that we're in. It also gives us a little bit of a description of where we are, and it also provides a possible date. Or date range in modern.
Yes, for the event. For the event,
yes,
that's happening.
For the events and that. And this is all. And of course, there's the margin summaries on the left that attempt to explain in clear English what the frick Herodotus just said in that paragraph. Use all of that if you can. And I just wanted to just say a word about it.
Yeah, I think so. Because I don't have my landmark sitting in front of me, I didn't.
Yeah,
I didn't think about that. Now, does anyone else? We have about. We're going to take a couple more minutes on the call. Does anyone? I think was that. I can't remember who I heard. Was it Maggie whose voice I heard sort of creeping up before Phil started talking, or was that someone else?
No, the last thing I said was that I hadn't considered that it wasn't
monolithic. I heard a female voice typing in.
There was a voice. So who was that? Yeah.
Lisa. We have calls. Is there anyone else who would like to add something else about maybe let's go around to everyone as we're sort of ending up this round of call, and just have each person sort of point out what their favorite part of the reading was so far from book one and why, and then that's something for us to think about sort of as we move forward, what things are jumping out at us particularly. So why don't we start with Leah and see if you want to say something.
Oh boy. I'm not sure I can choose a favorite. I loved everything about Pisistratus. I loved the Battle of Champions. That weird dream about Mandane and the woman who peed everywhere. I'm a teenager. I find this stuff like incredibly hilarious. But I think my favorite would be the Miletian food strategy in 1.21, landmark page 14. Thrasybulus gave orders to bring together into the public square a bunch of meat and food, and everybody, and it says a huge pile of food heaped up and the people having a good time there, and that is just what happened. The Herald saw these things going on, and after communicating the Lydian message to Thrasybulus, returned to Sardis, and as far as I can tell, this is the only reason for the turnabout to peace that followed. I just think that's so beautiful. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's just really good food and good drink, bringing people together, and and I just have this
that's
image.
You know, that's Mediterranean for you.
Oh yeah, that's Mediterranean for you. And I just have this image in my head of a bunch of ancient Greeks just having a good time with a big old pile of food.
All right, thanks, Leah. Lisa, did you want to say something about what you enjoyed from the reading so far? Oh, maybe we don't have her anymore. Maybe she fell off. Kevin, did you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I have a few things to say. I love the idea because I'm a poet, and I find drinking wine helpful. I love the idea that the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Scythians, their councils, they would decide things
sober and then reevaluate it when they're drunk or vice versa. I thought that was a wonderful procedure. And, of course, the Babylonian marriage market was a really fantastic scene, and it's often painted by painters. But in terms of literature, I was just really struck that this became one of the sources of Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, the story of, you know, of Astyages, the shepherd, and the killing of the child. I mean, it becomes one of the sources for the play. I've read, you know, over a dozen essays on
Oedipus. I don't know if it's a source so much as a shared.
It seems to me that it's a source. Sophocles is using that plot in his play.
Yeah, but we don't know which one of these came first.
Which one came first?
I often hedge away from things.
Sophocles is a couple of centuries later than Herodotus.
No, Sophocles wrote the play The Oedipus in 429 BC. It was performed.
429.
Yeah, and this is potentially published maybe in 430.
And, of course, the Oedipus myth is much older than both of them.
Yeah,
I know, but that part's not here. But that's just the shepherd part.
It might be a shared myth pool, a shared folklore motif in myth pool.
Okay, and I was also wondering about the Romulus and Remus, Rome, Etruscan, which is followed that in 1.122.
We don't have evidence of the myth of Romulus and Remus in Italy that predates, I think, the 3rd or 4th century. So it's almost contemporary, but maybe a little later.
He does talk about this Persian settlement in the Etruscan area north of Rome.
And I just want to put this out as a fun fact.
Sorry, what?
People have doubted Herodotus was right about this. DNA studies were just released that actually demonstrate that the Etruscans were actually from Turkey, from modern Turkey.
From Turkey, okay, fine, okay.
So then Herodotus is correct. Herodotus was right. They are, in fact, probably of Anatolian, they're Anatolian, which is Persia. So,
okay, that's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. Right. Okay, Katerina, did you want to point out your favorite before we move along to get wrapped up here?
Yeah, I don't think I could answer that fairly, not having read the entire book. I just
you can make it up.
Yeah, so I'll focus on the opening, which is always important. I think I appreciated its clarity of purpose, and especially how misleading it is, because it becomes so complex afterwards, and so you really have to perk up and pay attention. So I love the way he opened with the authority, and you know you're about to be told a very long and interesting tale. So that's about all I could say about it right now.
But very insightful. So thank you.
Right.
Dwight.
Hi. You know, the thing that really hooks me on this is I had not read this before the movie The English Patient. And so Gyges, when you read that and it's like, you know, within the first two or three pages, it hooked me. And you read all these stories that are just as good, and you know, obviously didn't receive the same press or whatever. I thought was great, and it just reminded me. It's like this is a masterful storyteller. This is a guy you want to invite over to dinner and drink a couple of glasses or bottles of wine with. As Phil mentioned earlier, it's like you'll study Thucydides, and the question would be, who do you want to invite over for dinner? Herodotus or Thucydides? And, you know, to me, the answer is simple. You want Herodotus.
But you definitely wouldn't want Candaeus for a husband, for God's sake.
Yeah, watch out.
But do I have to choose? Can I get them both for dinner?
Yeah, why not? Candaeus, too.
All right, Andrew.
Well, there were lots of favorites, but Arion and the Dolphin, we haven't mentioned that yet, and I certainly enjoyed that. I certainly enjoyed paragraph 203, where he just kind of casually mentions that the people of Caucasus, the Caucasus Mountains, a.k.a. Caucasians, engage in intercourse in the open just like animals.
Awakened Men. Yeah, again, that was one of my faves too. You know, teenage girl, that was totally one of my faves too.
He just kind of tosses out these rather shocking, just like in a sentence, observations. But my favorite part had to be the speech that Solon gave to Croesus. Paragraphs 29 through 33, where Croesus is expecting Solon to tell him that he's the happiest man in the world. And Solon instead informs him who he thinks actually were the happiest men in the world, and the reason why they were happy was not because they were wealthy and materialistic and everything that Croesus was, but because they lived a life of meaning and purpose and they didn't care much about money. I see Herodotus the philosopher and Herodotus the tragedian coming out in that sequence.
Well, some people think and I have a hard time disagreeing with it, even though I hate broad general statements like this. But some people think that story is the keynote, the keystone for the entirety of Herodotus.
That story
is the one that sets us where Herodotus wants us to go and gives us the lesson that we can take through every book. It's hard to disagree with it when you read it, but then, you know, you sort of hate having the sort of broad generalization at the same time. But it's such a powerful story that stands out and really does hit all of the things that are going to come back again and again and again throughout the history.
I'm sorry, if I can just add one more thing. It gets back to what we call Herodotus and what we expect from him. Is he a historian? Is he a mythographer? Is he a tragedian? What is he? I would say all of the above.
All of the above, yep.
Philosopher. Right. I mean, that's what's remarkable about this text. You can't pin him down into one role. He's all of the above.
Yep. Thanks, Andrew. We're running out of a little bit of time here, so I want to move on and have Maggie give her a parting shot.
Well, I loved the dolphins, but I can tell you one thing: if my husband had done this to me, I wouldn't be as detached and cold and calculating as the queen was, because she doesn't say anything. Herodotus says she keeps quiet. She doesn't say anything initially. And then summons Gyges the next day and says, look, you have two options. You can either do yourself in or kill my husband. That's one cold, calculating woman. I kind of couldn't help but laugh and be surprised a little bit. I think I would have lost my cool.
Well, I read that story the first time as an undergraduate when I was about 19. And you better bet it had a bit of a shock value in our class. As college kids, whoa. All right, Bill.
I would have to say this, to be brief, just two things that really catch my attention. One is the maps included with the text, the appreciation of not only the locations, but the distances involved in some of these activities. That's just really great. And he is a masterful storyteller and has certainly sunk the hook in me. But my favorite part of the book one was the tail end story of Queen Tomyris, who is just telling old Cyrus, your luck has run out, bring it on, big boy, and defeated him in the battle there. That was just I thought a very interesting turn of events to see a different ruler face up to the most powerful nation at that location and bring it to a close so quickly.
Yeah, she's pretty awesome, I have to say. All right, Alexander, are you there?
I thought one of the most interesting aspects was Herodotus's sort of skeptical attitude toward the oracles. And it's not just about the unreliability of the interpretation of the prophecies, but in some parts he's questioning the institutions themselves. First of all, in the story of Gyges, where I think it's strongly implied that Delphi was bribed into the prophecy that gave him the kingship. And then the story about Croesus, who's testing the various oracles to find out which ones are the real deal and which ones are fake. And that struck me as this sort of empirical experimentation against religion. It struck me as an enlightenment attitude. And I didn't expect it out of the ancient Greeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he is part of the Ionian, what we call the Ionian Enlightenment movement, which is the sort of birth of scientific thought amongst the Greeks in this period. So it's a really great observation. Thank you. All right, Fred, do you want to please close us out here?
Yeah, I my favorite part actually where, you know, Croesus is captured, and yet he becomes like chief advisor to Cyrus. Cyrus takes his enemy king's advice, and I'm harkening back to Machiavelli sitting in prison writing letters to the Medici. So I just love that part.
Yeah.
I question it strikes me as one of these things where you just hired the CEO who like sunk his Fortune 500 company to run yours. That's the wisest choice.
Yes. Although to be fair, Croesus seems to not have, bungled and corrupt in a whole bunch of ways. He made a major mistake here, right, with the oracle.
He recognized his error, though.
Yes. Can I just add my favorite passage here at the end? I love Solon and the conversation. That's actually had a profound impact on me. I also, on page 5 of Landmark Edition, which is we're in sort of 1.5, mm-hmm. if you don't have that text, it's sort of at the end of the introduction where Herodotus says, essentially, since many of the, he says, I will recount cities both lesser and great. Mm-hmm. Many of those that were great long ago have become inferior, and some that are great in my own time were inferior before. And so, resting on my knowledge that human prosperity never remains constant, I shall make mention of both without discrimination.
Yep.
One of my favorite passages in all of Herodotus, actually. And I'll say, before the real estate bust, I gave a lot of talks in the business world, and I led with that quote. And this real estate thing isn't, an infinite spiral up. There's going to be some problems that occur with this, that prosperity never remains constant, and we need to be aware of it. I had no idea how bad it was going to be. I didn't fully understand all of the mechanisms, but I understood this. And it turns out if you understand this, if you understand Herodotus and you understand that human prosperity never remains constant, it will be a great way to conduct your affairs in life and to approach things always with a sense of humility, which is also what I get from the Solon story. So,
yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Phil. I really appreciate you adding that in. So we are actually over time, so we're going to go ahead and wrap up so everyone can get on with their lives wherever they are, whichever part of the country or in the world. I want to thank everyone. Our next call is going to be Wednesday, October 15th. And if possible, one of the things that might be helpful for you, because it is a daunting text, is to maybe try and read a little bit here and there every day, and then make sure you sort of make some little notes to yourself. I don't think, everyone knows their own reading pace and their own reading style, but it might help a little bit to try and tackle it a little bit at a time. Whatever you choose to do, please make sure you write down your questions, and you can post them up to Facebook, or you can email them to me, and then we can sort of keep a tab of them so that we have things to work with. And I will post up and send out about a week before, or maybe sooner. Maybe I'll do it earlier so you guys can have them. Just some suggested topics that we might want to talk about next time as well. And just sort of looking at the schedule, did I print the schedule out? Is the question. So October 15th, I can't remember if we're doing just book 2 or if we're doing 2 and 3 together, but I'll make sure I clarify that.
I think it's just book 2.
We'll clarify. That is the Egyptian excursus. So it's
and by the way, you're going to love the Egyptians. if you like some of those weird descriptions in book one, he described some of his descriptions of Egyptian culture will be quite entertaining.
Oh yeah, I'm so ready.
Yeah, he's fascinated by Egypt. So, all right,
me
thank
too.
You,
we have that in common.
Yes. Thank you, everyone. I hope
thank
you have
you.
A nice rest of your evening.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. All right. Bye. Bye. See you next month.
Bye now.
Hey, Rebecca, can you give me a quick call?
Sure. On your regular phone number.
Do you have my phone number? Yeah.
You emailed it to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, thank you. All right. Yeah. Give me a quick call. Okay. Cool.